This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and selamat hari raya. I'm Azif Fazuddin.
Salam Aidilfitri. I'm Aisyah Tajuddin.
And welcome to the show that puts the news and the media in the spotlight. This week, we are rebroadcasting an old episode we did last year where we spoke to an American Muslim journalist, Anissa Mehdi, on her documentary Inside Mecca.
But before that, we have three stories from Asia Calling. Refugees in limbo get a new shelter in Aceh. Female victims of the Nepal earthquakes learn self-defense. And in Pakistan, the sweltering heat wave kills thousands.
Hundreds of Rohingya and Bangladeshi refugees and migrants are being moved to a new shelter in Aceh, Indonesia. The government said that hundreds of Rohingya refugees who are rescued off the coast of Aceh can stay in government-run shelters in Langsa for a year. They will also provide educational assistance for school-aged refugees and help reunite separated families. But beyond that, their future is uncertain. Rio Tuasikal reports.
...35-year-old Rohingya refugee Muhammad Amin has become responsible for making government announcement to group. Today, he is telling them about the playgroup schedule for children. He lived in Malaysia for 3 months and can speak some Malay. He would like to stay in Aceh.
With God's will, I can do everything. But outside of our control, if the Achenese people wants to help us, if Indonesia government wants to give us job, it is their decision, not ours.
Amin is one of the 400 Rohingya refugees who were saved by Aceh fishermen. They wanted to reach Malaysia, but the ship broke down and they rescued off the coast of Aceh after being stranded at sea for more than 2 months. Ibrahim, one of the fishermen who saved him, says he is ready to have new neighbors.
They have never begged us for food. So, as long as the government is looking after them, it's not a problem having them here. They are kind and polite just like us. We're both Muslims. The only differences we have is our language.
Karena dia Muslim, kita Muslim, jadi etikanya tidak jauh beda, bahasa yang beda.
But not everyone feels the same way. Muhammad comes from a poor fishing family.
Macam kami yang rakyat kecil nih.
We are poor too. If we get work, then we can eat. If not, we don't have food. No one cares about us. But with these people, they're giving them lots of aid.
When the Indonesian Minister for Social Affairs came to the camp, she made the issue of jealousy.
We need to have a good communication to build social harmony between the refugees and locals. We need to identify what is the source of jealousy. We will work toward the best option for resettlement. We are still writing the rules about refugees.
Bagian penguatan keserasian sosial gitu. Ya, nanti ini perpresnya juga sedang disusun.
17-year-old Ismatara, a Rohingya from Myanmar, needs to get to Malaysia and try again to get there.
My husband lives in Malaysia. I always miss my husband, brother and grandfather. I want to live with them.
Hassan, who has been living in refugee camp in Bangladesh, wants to continue his education.
If I go to Malaysia, I will be a study there. Because in Myanmar, there is no way. Also in Bangladesh, there is no way for us to study. if I go to Malaysia and I will transfer to another country, I will request this government, if they give me some scholarship, I will study and I will change my life. Which country give me, allow me to study, I will go to that country.
From Langsa Aceh, I am Rio Tuasikal for Asia Calling.
You know, Aisha, the story of migration is really an age-old one. And it's funny, when I think about it, we're all migrants and ancestors of migrants. Yet nowadays, we see reactions from people who say we don't want migration, yet discounting that the fact is, migration is exactly how we grow countries and economies. And if you trace back long enough, you'd find that I think you and I descended even from migrants.
It's true, Azif. My grandfather is from Padang, if I'm not mistaken, and my grandma, she's from Minang. So we all came from somewhere on a boat. Where are your grandparents from?
Well, my grandparents are from Negeri Sembilan and Johor, but I'm sure if I trace back my ancestry and from what I heard, I may have Arab descendants, possibly.
Wow, yeah. See, we all came from somewhere. And for this story, this is a piece of good news, what the Indonesian government is doing to help the refugees and, you know, not just dismiss them like some governments. They took the trouble to provide educational help for the ones who want to be in school and help reunite lost families. And among all the distressing news we've received lately, like the mass graves discovered in Perlis and Thailand and the boat people, this little ray of hope is refreshing.
Police in Nepal have started self-defense lessons for women and girls in camps for people displaced by massive earthquakes earlier this year. It's in response to several cases of sexual assault and an increase in sexual harassment. More than 8,700 people died in the two major earthquakes that hit Nepal on April 25th and May 12th, destroying nearly 500,000 houses and leaving thousands camping out in the open. Rajan Parajuli attended one of these training sessions.
The open field of Jabal, the northeast of Kathmandu, is filled with tarpaulin tents. All of these people are displaced from Kathmandu and outside due to the massive earthquake. Around 50 women have gathered in the central part of the open field, making a large circle. They are standing and closely watching three women police officers at the center. Two police officers are performing the role of women and abuser on the other side.
When someone tries to pull you, force you, they will try hard, and you also need to be strong. You cannot look weak.
Police officer Pramila Khadka is explaining different self-defense tools. And police officers practically showing this to the people.
Today and yesterday, we taught them different techniques to protect herself. Tomorrow, I will teach them how to grab an enemy's neck and put them on the ground. Many women have told us that they are also beaten by their husbands and have their hair pulled. We will teach them what to do if someone pulls your hair.
After police showed the example, all participants were divided into pairs and they practiced it on the field. ...21-year-old Sajana Lama has been staying in the tent for a month after her rented room collapsed in Kathmandu due to earthquake. Her home in Ramechhap district also turned into rubble. It's her third day in the training.
I felt I really needed to learn this. We are unsafe, especially in the evening and night when we are alone. We have heard about rape and violence. Strange boys tease us and they try to touch us. Before, I always tried to avoid it and run. But now, I know how to injure the person before I run.
Nepal police started the defense training class after two cases of rape and five cases of attempt to rape were reported from these temporary camps.
Definitely, the earthquake has added something, but what our societal value or the kind of the mindset of men who always think that women's body can be used as a commodity is the main reason for this one.
Dr. Renu Adhikari is the chairperson of Women Rehabilitation Center. Her team has been traveling to all 11 earthquake-affected districts and helping women to be safe from possible violence. She says earthquake has added series of vulnerability to women and adolescent girls.
Unknown faces were there, you know, teasing the young girls, talking to them in a particular way, you know, looking at them, staring. And then all, and then when you ask them, who are you and what you are doing, we are trying to help.
Back in the training, 30-year-old Tasi Doma is asking the trick to escape and run. She says she needs it every day at her home.
I really want to be able to run away. At my home, my brother-in-law hits me. My husband hits me. I'm living with pain. The training has given me the confidence. Now I think I can protect myself and run away in time before I am injured more.
For Asia Calling, I'm Rajan Parajuli from Kathmandu.
As if it's not enough for these women to have lost everything to the earthquakes, that like their loved ones and their homes, they have to also suffer the constant terror of being attacked. How does one even begin to rebuild their lives back when they can't even feel safe anymore? But I'd like to applaud the Nepal government for trying to address the situation. That is a good effort. But there are still societal issues that need to be resolved.
Exactly. And I think we have to look at this as part of a larger symptom, where the scary thing about disasters really isn't about the disaster itself. It's the aftermath you have to worry about. One of the themes dystopian novels, and yes, I read a lot of those, you know, one of the themes they play on a lot is this anarchic system where the rule of law doesn't exactly exist. You know, and while the situation in Nepal is far from what you call dystopic, the aftermath of a disaster certainly does create a sense of lawlessness when authorities are trying to fix things structurally. And women in this case suffer most from feeling unsafe. Days after a heatwave in Pakistan killed about 1,300 people, many are still puzzled by the unusually high number of deaths in the port city of Karachi. The city is experiencing its hottest summer in 30 years with temperatures as high as 45 degrees. Hospitals and mortuaries are struggling to cope. People are being told to stay indoors, but with long hours of power outages, it's hard to find anywhere cool. Naim Sahutra reports from the city.
Aladino rushes his 60-year-old father into emergency. He's half unconscious and is finding it difficult to breathe. This 200-bed Jinnah Postgraduate Medical Centre is full. The trauma centre is also overcrowded. The medical staff are confused about which patient to treat first. After 10 minutes of waiting, a nurse checks the pulse of Aladino's father. She waves her hand to pronounce him dead. In the corner are the bodies of two disabled men. Dr. Simin Jamali says they also died of heat stroke.
The cause of death is absolutely heat stroke, and people have come here with heat stroke and heat exhaustion. Mostly people have died of a heat stroke. They have been brought in an unconscious condition, pulseless, BP-less on arrival, and they have collapsed while coming to the hospital. Some of them were declared dead on arrival and some of them have passed away in the casualty.
Summers in Karachi are usually quite nice. The cool sea breeze makes the evenings pleasant. However, this year there was no breeze and it's been incredibly hot. It's also the Islamic fasting month and most people are not drinking or eating during daylight hours. Some Muslim scholars have issued a decree or a fatwa saying that in extreme weather people don't need to fast. Dr. Jamali says under these conditions people should be at least drinking.
I suggest that people do not go out in the heat if it is not desired. And people may not exercise, they may use loose clothing, cotton clothing, and they should use umbrellas and straw hats or sun hats to protect themselves. If it is not required, they should be well hydrated, and if it is not required to go out, they should stay home and indoors.
The army has set up special heat stroke relief camps on the roads where they're handing out wet towels that drip icy cold water. Most of the deaths took place in the congested slum areas where the electricity supply gets cut off for hours at a time. Mohammed Billa is in charge of the city's largest morgue.
Last night, we announced that people should not bring any more bodies because we've run short of space to accommodate them. Now, we are just providing coffins and ablution and return the bodies.
Meteorologist Mohammed Hanif says what's happening is a sign of global warming.
20 years ago, the country has the fall season lasting for maximum 150 days. But today, it has expanded to 180 days. So the entire system of the winter and summer seasons has changed. The change patterns have increased the frequency of natural disasters.
He says one of the factors responsible for the fast-changing weather patterns is deforestation. The country has the highest rate of deforestation in South Asia.
Looking at the ongoing trends of deforestation, pollution and urbanization, it seems that many more disasters will take place in different parts of the country with more intensity in the future.
For Asia Calling, this report was produced by Naim Samudra in Karachi.
And there you have it. Deforestation. You know, strip nature bare and you'd eventually end up with a myriad of problems. And with over 1,000 deaths in Pakistan, I think the government really has to work on a sustainable policy that protects not only the environment but provides also for the people. And that's a very hard balance to find.
We're going through our own dose of a heat wave here in Malaysia, where temperatures have reached borderline 36 degrees in some areas. And at home, I noticed there's a spike in my electricity bill due to the constant use of aircon, sorry Dad, which I'm sure that every family in Malaysia is experiencing the same thing, right? Just to stay cool. And this is a worldwide issue. It's not just us. Nepal is also suffering the same problem, with the death toll going over 1,000 people dying from heat stroke. And London, surprisingly London, they recorded their hottest day ever in late June at 28 degrees.
Asia Calling was produced by Kantor Berita Radio 68H in Jakarta. And after the break, we explore an old episode we did last year with Anissa Mehdi, an American Muslim filmmaker, on her documentary Inside Mecca. I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
You're listening to The Week in Review, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Azif Azuddin.
And I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
And the weekend review continues.
So, Azif, how's your raya been? It's the third day now.
Not so bad when you're eating up on cookies and ketupats. You can see my stomach is not exactly as flat as it used to be a month ago.
Yeah, you do look a bit stuffed. But do I get your raya this year?
As long as you say I look good in a baju Melayu.
Sure. That will never happen. Producer Hanif will give me duit raya. I don't need it.
Okay. So anyway, apart from cookies and ketupats, as you guys heard, raya's just come around a few days ago. We're on the third day right now. And you know, while we're busy with celebrations and meeting family and, you know, just strengthening those bonds, this week, however, we are rebroadcasting an old episode I did last year with Anissa Mehdi, an American Muslim filmmaker.
Since the interview last year, Anissa's released her latest documentary, Sacred Journeys. It's about a group of American Muslims and their journey on the Hajj. This interview, though, isn't about Sacred Journeys, right? It's the one she did before that.
Exactly. The one I talked to her about in this interview is about Inside Mecca. Now, this one's received a lot of accolades. And yes, even though it's Eid al-Fitri and, you know, we're months away from Eid al-Adha, which is in this country also known as Hari Raya Haji, you know, I feel it's worth for us to reflect on the nature of spiritual journeys, even if they are in different forms. So I asked her, how do Muslim journalists like herself play a role in this course post-9/11?
The role, our job, is to look at a bigger picture. And I don't feel that that is accomplished most of the time. Often what news media does is it highlights the point of view of a nation. Whatever nation you're living in, whatever nation you're a part of, that's the story you tell. And it is from that point of view that you inform your audience. But for me, and I'm imagining for you too, because you're engaging in this inquiry, there's a bigger story to tell. And it has to do with our humanity. when I look at the way stories are told about religion in the United States of America, sometimes there's an ignorance about the variety of religious traditions we appreciate in this country. Because this is a great, huge country with somebody from everywhere on the planet is here. And so we have a lot of different stories, faith stories to tell. But until our reporters are informed about different faith traditions, they can't report them accurately. And with regard to Islam in particular, there's been a tremendous amount of ignorance. Now, since 9/11, the good thing is that reporters have been put back in the field. Because of wars, they've gone back to bureaus in Iraq. There are bureaus in Afghanistan. There are bureaus around the world where reporters have firsthand opportunity to learn. And they come back then say, hey, you know, there's a connection between Islam and Christianity and Judaism and Hinduism. And it seems that the parallel, people like to use the metaphor, is there's a mountain with many paths to the top. And that many of our faith traditions globally are all aiming for the top, which has to do with good behavior and being respectful of one another. But we follow different trails up that mountain. So I'm pleased with how the American news media is beginning to transform itself in that direction.
Now, being a journalist and being a person who carries the voice of these different communities, what challenges do you find? Is there apprehensions to this documentation, the representation?
The hardest thing for me is getting the word out, because I don't focus on the trauma and the drama and the tragedy. Here they don't like the good news stories. Here they don't like the stories that bring people together at the end. There seems to be a focus on what is going wrong with our societies.
You mentioned about how the media seems to focus more on tragedies and the problems, but not so much on the solutions that we can come forward with. But essentially, right. Do you feel that that is somehow the nature of the media, to point out what's wrong, but also by pointing that out is where you find solutions?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. We have to show what's wrong in order to be able to say what's next. But I think it's also essential that we report on the solutions people are coming up with. We as reporters, it's not our job, is it, to say, here's a solution. I've got a good idea. Why don't we do this? We are the third side. We're the observers. But we can say, I saw this problem, and I saw these people who are addressing it. And so I'm going to tell you about the problem, and I'm going to tell you about some of the mediations going on, some of the solutions, some of the opportunities to make this better. But often I find we only say, this isn't working, and that's bad, and here's a death, and there's a tragedy. And we don't say what happens to a family when they were evicted from their home because they couldn't pay the rent, or because there was a fire or something. You know, we don't ever say what happened next, you know, the happily ever after part. And there is no happily ever after in the American fairy tale or the human fairy tale. But there are often postludes and epilogues that say, this helped. And that's where I think we fall short as journalists.
And this is where I want to go on and talk about the National Geographic documentary Inside Macaw. Now, your writings on the documentary seems that it was a very moving journey for you. So could you tell us a bit more about the journey, the challenges you faced in making this documentary?
With making Inside Macaw, by the time I got to cover the Hajj in 2003 for Inside Macaw, National Geographic, I had been through it once. You know, I thought I had my feet on the ground. I had an idea of what difficulties I might face. And I'll confess to you that I had that thought in 2013, just last October, when I covered the Hajj again. Oh, I know what I'm getting myself into. But, you know, life has its ways of turning you upside down and letting you know that whatever you think you know, you don't know. It's just like that. So never let your confidence get in the way of your sensitivity to the situation. It was as hard a thing as I've ever done, but such a joy. The people that we covered and followed, the Irish-American woman, Fidelma O'Leary, the South African man Khalil Mandlazi, and the Malaysian man Ismail Mahbub, each of them was a person of great faith, great generosity, great articulation of the experience. And it was, what can I say, it was a producer's dream to spend time with them. And I had a brilliant crew, each of whom worked 19 hours a day without taking a breath, to make sure that we were able to capture each moment of the pilgrimage. And we had our travails. The big place where the pilgrimage takes place. You start in the city of Mecca, then you leave the city of Mecca, you and 2 or 3 million of your favorite people, right? And so we had to find our three mm-hmm. people amongst these 3 million. And every once in a while we couldn't. And so we'd have our own mini crises. But we managed to get through, and with each crisis was another learning opportunity for me personally and for my crew.
It was premiered on one of our local Muslim television, Astro Oasis.
Nice. That was such a fun film to make. I say fun, it was deeply moving and inspiring, but because the team that I worked with in Mecca, of course, all were Muslim, but the production team, the editing team, were people of all different faiths and people of no faith. And yet each of us, the composer, the editor, the executive producers, each went through his or her own journey of pilgrimage as we edited the film. It was a wonderful community experience.
I understand that there would be logistical problems, seeing that especially where there are millions of people gathered in one area at one time, and shooting is definitely not easy. How is it like?
You're telling me? Well, it was crowded. You know, it was crowded, so you had to be light. You had to use a small camera, not as small as some, like not an iPhone. We used, for Inside Mecca, Sony PD-150s, so it fits in two hands, so you could cradle it between your shoulders when you needed to move quickly. And we put the camera on a monopod. Tripod sits on the ground and holds a shot nice and steady. A monopod is one stick, and you can extend it so it goes high up above a crowd, and you can balance it on your chest like a flagpole. So you get a much broader perspective of what's going on, especially when a crowd is pushing and shoving and there's a lot of chaos. So we had to tailor our equipment to fit the scenario. And then there were things that happened that we couldn't get to because we couldn't get there in time. You had to walk. You can't drive in a crowd like that. And nobody knows exactly where to go. So, yeah, go down 3 blocks and take a left, and then you see a person selling falafel on the corner. And if you take a right there and you go a little farther, there's somebody selling incense, and you go past him, you know. So you just have to go with the flow.
I can imagine, given the very unpredictable nature of the Hajj itself also. I also want to talk about the challenges you also face with documenting, right? Now, have your works been criticized by the more conservative who say that your representation of what Islam and Muslim is not exactly accurate?
Sure, there has. Of course there has. And that's one of the things that I have to say I appreciate about Islam and Muslims, that there is no single way of looking at something. I can also say that is something that it's just absolutely horrifying to me about Islam and Muslims, that there is no single way people look at things. When you look at what is the absolute just calamity that is happening in my father's homeland, Iraq, now, and that people who are committing atrocities claim to be Muslims, I just, you know, I recoil in anger, and it just makes me crazy that people with those very evil intentions say that they're part of the same religious community I'm part of. But that has happened in all religious communities. It happened in Christianity with the Crusades, and it happens today in other parts of the world. It happens with Judaism. It happens with Hinduism. It happens. So that's just part of life. So with regard to my work, I was criticized with regard to Inside Mecca for having, for example, paintings. We used paintings from Renaissance times to illustrate the story of Abraham, as he was taking his wife Hagar to leave her in Mecca at God's command, separating his family because he had another wife, Sarah, with another son. And Hagar and Ishmael were left in Mecca, and Sarah and Isaac were kept in Canaan, which is now in the land of Palestine. So we used paintings to show this story because it's television. You have to have images. And I got criticized for using representational art. And I said to the man who called, a very respectable authority from Saudi Arabia, man in the government, and I said, this is television. I can't have black screen there. And he said, but we can't have representational art. And I said, I checked with my religious scholars, and it says nowhere in the Quran. There is no place in the holy book that you cannot have representational art. It is part of our culture. It's part of an assumption. It's part of a tradition, but it's not part of the law. And I, working with television, I have to use some imagery. So that kind of criticism. And then, you know, if a woman's hair isn't covered at all times, sometimes I get criticism from some sources. But you have to know, you have to first know your heart and what's right for you. And you have to also know the rules and be able to engage in polite conversation with people who argue with you or criticize you.
I understand, really, the fact that religion is very organic and also so diverse. I think it's also the beauty of it. So where do we go forward from here, right, in terms of interfaith discourse and how the media is used as a platform?
Well, one thing I think is that reporters need to get more religious instruction. And it's not about becoming religious. It's becoming knowledgeable in the traditions of the variety of practices out there. And so, for example, I, who have been covering religion since 1988, I'm now enrolling in a graduate school course in religious studies because I realize as much as I think I know, as we alluded to earlier, how much you know, watch out, it's going to trip you up. As much as I think I know, I have a lot to learn. So I'm going back to take some graduate school courses. So we need to be educated, and we need to remind ourselves to listen very, very generously to what other people are saying, even if it's not what we believe. We must train ourselves, and I think this is what reporters are supposed to do anyway, train ourselves to listen and be the flow-through for information. We shouldn't be a dam where information stops because it doesn't coincide with what our beliefs are. We still need to be a flow-through place for information. And I think it's going to take time, but I think we're on the road. There are many more reporters nowadays who are paying attention to issues of faith and how they impact people's behavior, you know, how citizens behave.
That was Anissa Mehdi, American Muslim filmmaker. Aisha, what do you think about the interview?
Well, I like the way how she says that there really isn't a single way of looking at things. And interfaith discourse is so important in the development of a society. And as reporters, you, me, Cheryl, and Hanif, we need to be more educated and knowledgeable and listen very generously to what others are saying, even though, you know, that's not what we believe in.
Exactly. And I think you're talking about inclusive journalism, where you want to understand the society by talking about the in-group culture, the in-group perspectives, as opposed to sort of rhetoric and journalism you've been seeing since post 9/11, where we look at Muslims or at least any other culture than ourselves as the outgroup and not making the attempt to understand. And I think what I like about Anissa Mehdi's interview, and again listening to it a year after, is that we've lost that ability to become interconnectors between societies and cultures.
Like she said, train ourselves to be the flow through and not be the dam that stops information. Create discussions.
Exactly, and especially in the spirit of Raya, where, you know, last week we just saw a mob, a riot happening in Lawiyat. I think that there should be a need for inclusive discourse where people come together and talk about these different cultures and understand why we need to come together, especially Malaysia right now needs that, I feel.
I hope this morning's show has been ketupat and rendang for thought.
And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. This has been The Week in Review. Selamat Hari Raya. I'm Azif Azuddin.
Salam Adil Fitri. I'm Aisha Tajuddin.
BFM 89.9,
The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.